Welcome, everybody, to the Strength Academy podcast. Mundo, once again here, joined with Grayson.
How's it going, everybody?
And today we are going to have a pretty decent conversation about some absurdity. But first, we're going to give you a little bit of dose of weightlifting news. And part of that news is that the IWF, which is the International Weightlifting Federation, decided to change some of the rules for 2019. A lot of them are still the same, obviously, but they decided to add a few things in there that caused a little bit of controversy over the past week. One of the first things being rule changes for video playback.
Yeah, so that's going to be really interesting. So as most of you guys are probably familiar now, having watched some of those competitions or taken part in them, there's the three referees and a jury that sits back behind them. So right now, the jury watches the lifts at the same time as the referees, and if the jury disagrees with the call from the refs, whether they think that person made the lift or did not, the jury will be able to overturn the decision of the referees. But now they're adding video playback for that jury, and that's gonna kinda change things, and I'm interested to know what you think, because should refereeing and, you know, judging these things be based on the eye? Should we trust the human eye and let the degree of fallibility that there is of watching something happen at full speed? Because I can see scenarios where adding a video playback could overturn lifts that would have been given if it was at full speed and you could only watch it once. But I can also see them going the other way and saying, no, that was a good lift. It was shoulder movement, not elbow movement. So like, what do you think? Should we trust people to make those refereeing decisions, or how much technology should we incorporate into the like lift making?
Well, if you've watched any other sports, particularly football, this is a big one in football where they have replay, timeouts and things like that. You can like the coach can throw a flag out and basically call a timeout and get a video replay of a play where something happened that could potentially change the whole direction of the game. So a lot of the time I think that referees, especially in weightlifting, they make the right call. There are times when it just seems maybe they were a bit harsh, more so on one lifter than another, or something was inconsistent among the consensus on the jury or the referees. So I think in those cases, the video replay will be an invaluable tool, but I don't think that every single lift should be under video replay. I think that maybe if you're in the A session in a nationals or some, you know, high level weightlifting event, then maybe that could be something that comes into play. When you're at Worlds, or especially in the Olympics, when the medals are on the line, when you have those top three lifts being made for those medal spots and those podium spots, those are probably ideal scenarios in which you could rely on video playback. But I don't think that it should be done like on a continual basis. It's like you shouldn't be going back every 5 minutes and saying, oh well, no, that was a no lift, there was a little bit of wiggle in the elbow. Like it's not a move to make refereeing more stringent. It's a move to make the evaluation of lifts more accurate when you get to a level where it actually makes a difference. And when you're lifting maximal body weight lifts, or, you know, like lifts that are double body weight snatch, clean and jerks that are well over, I think that there's going to be a small amount of give. There's going to be a tiny bit of elbow movement, but how much they should give to that in consideration when they're, how much of that they should consider when they're doing a video replay, I don't know how they're going to determine that.
I think it kind of depends on the speed of the video replay, because I'm sure, like, you've noticed, because I have, that when you watch some, like, world records and stuff in that, like, ultra high rate slow motion that Hook Grip puts out and All Things Gym.
Right.
Sometimes you see little tiny wobbles in the recovery and the jerk that you don't see at full speed. Like, the lift looks very different at full speed than it does when it takes a minute to finish. So I think the speed at which the camera replay is could kind of determine, like, how strict is this going to get.
Right.
But I also, like, I don't think that there's anything in there, like, coaches being able to call for a replay.
Yeah.
But that's what I worry about, is just, like, you know, will it devolve to a point where everybody's saying, no, my lifter made this, and then D sessions are taking twice as long because they're having to review every press out, you know?
Yeah, I hope that's not the case, because, like, your lift should not be getting reviewed in the D session. Like, it really is not that big of a deal. Like I said, they should probably reserve it for the highest session, the podium potential lifts, and, you know, medal potential lifts. There shouldn't be this, every, like I said, this back and forth, because I know I could see it happening right now. You know, some coach in the E session, you know, every other lift that, you know, his lifter got called on, making a fuss about it and wanting a video replay and just slowing down the whole process. So I really don't think that's going to be how it's going to get implemented.
Hopefully that's not the case. That would be, it kind of makes me think, like, what if we were to kind of implement advanced technology into weightlifting and eliminate refereeing, like, what do you think, like you just set up a video camera and a computer program analyzes where your arm's locked when your feet landed?
Yeah.
How important is the human role in determining, you know, like, the quality of the competition? Like, do we want to remove, you know, the referee class?
That's a good question, because I'm sure that you could, with present day technology, you could use a camera to determine the speed of descent of the lifter, right? Plus, you could add in the elbow angle at the full descended position and calculate if the arms were locked out once the lifter had fully reached a bottom position. Because that's what the rules state anyway, is that the lifter has to reach a locked out position before they sit into the squat. So you can still be descending and still continue to be locking out at the same time. It just happens so quickly that it's almost imperceptible. And we just catch those as referees. We're catching those moments where the lockout doesn't happen simultaneously. So technically, could you get rid of the human element of refereeing? Yeah, you could. And it would be probably 100% accurate.
Or at least consistent.
But what if the lifter's not facing the camera directly? Or, like, what kind of degree of view does the camera have to be able to make those calculations and things like that? So, I mean, it is possible. It's just, do we want to eliminate another human element from another sport,
basically? Yeah, because I know that there was, like, some controversy when they added video playback to baseball. And I'm sure that when they added it to football and other things, I'm sure there were protests saying, well, but, you know, like, why are we going to just rely on this? It's supposed to be the referee's job is to make that call.
Right.
And it's not the referee plus his computer.
Right.
So I think it'll be interesting to see if anything really changes within that. I'm not really sure. I guess we'll find out at the next major competition.
But. Yeah, I think more than anything, it'll be a tool that the jury uses. So the juries more than likely are going to be in the A session anyway. They're going to be in the sessions where the maximal lifts are being taken and the podium spots are more being vied for. So the juries are going to be the ones that are going to have access to the video playback. So it'll be a tool that they use in conjunction with what they've already saw. You know, so if there's a referee decision and they already see that there's something that wasn't quite right about it and they're already going back to deliberate, they just have an extra tool to look at and say, yeah, this is exactly what I thought I saw, and this is why the lift should be overturned. So it's just a tool to reinforce what's already taking place.
And I think as long as it's used for that, I think that'll be good. Where I kind of worry is if the jury becomes over-reliant on that, and instead of just using it when they disagree with the referees, if they start going back and rewatching every lift of the competition, because then the referees aren't really doing anything. It's right. just video review by the jury. So I think they should really only use it in those times that they disagree. And I just want to, I just hope that it doesn't become the jury basically making all the decisions with video playback
right.
a minute after the referees. So I yeah. think that as long as they don't end up essentially negating the need for a referee, because then if it's just video playback with the jury, just make them the referees.
Yeah. Right, yeah. just have the referees give them the ability to have video playback.
And then, yeah.
And then you'll get your no lift or good lift like a minute later instead of instantaneously on the platform.
Yeah, so that as long as that doesn't happen, I'm not too worried about that one. The other rule I kind of misunderstood, but you explained to me, I thought it was that you had to finish your lift facing the center judge, but apparently the new rule just stipulates that you need to start your lift facing the center judge.
Yeah, which I thought was silly.
Which I thought was already kind of the rule, because what else, how else would you start? That's where the loaders put the bar. So I don't really understand the need for that, but yeah. I guess it doesn't really change much of anything for me or anybody that I have ever seen lift, so.
Yeah, because like under incorrect movements, I guess it's rule 2.5.1.9, and it says that not facing the center referee at the beginning of the lift will result in a no lift, in an incorrect lift. So I
don't know if people are just trying to game angles, so it's like you're less likely to see your left arm. So
I don't know, maybe. Well, because like there's been times where you're facing that center judge and there's a light directly in your face or something, or you might want to turn. So maybe that's why. But for the IWF to do it, like across, because the IWF is the international governing body for weightlifting. So this is across the world. This isn't just the United States. This isn't just at, you know, your backyard meet. This is the world stage. This is going to be for the Olympic stage as well. I don't understand why you wouldn't face the center judge. Like, that's the loaders load the bar that way. Like, you're facing the center judge. I don't think I've seen any videos of anybody doing otherwise either. So it's just an odd
rule yeah.
to bring about.
I mean, it seems like they're enforcing what already happens without fail.
Yeah.
Which just kind of seems like a unnecessary rule. But I think the most controversial and the most fun of these new rules that has had everybody arguing in the comment sections is you are no longer able to move the barbell with your foot.
Touch the barbell
yeah, with your foot.
You can't even put your foot on it. And so rule 2.5.1.11 is basically, it results in a no lift if you touch the barbell with your footwear. So if any part of your footwear touches the barbell, and that includes the plates, then it results in a no lift.
And that's kind of interesting. Some of the perspectives I've read about this are along the lines of, well, why are you making this a rule? Because it really doesn't happen that often. So if you watch, the majority of people don't really touch the bar with their feet.
Right.
A couple people do it. I know Tyler likes to kind of get the bar moving a little bit and then kind of pull it back in with his hands. But, I mean, think about how many world championships you've watched. How many times have you seen, it's like 1 in 25 people. It's not like a really common issue.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem like a thing that's like rampant or causing damage to the bar.
Well, so here's why I think it's odd. I think it's something that Americans do more than anything. So I kind of see it as a rule that's generated toward Americans, because we have a tendency to be disrespectful toward the equipment. And I don't think there's a whole lot of other countries that have cultural etiquette surrounding the barbell that involves kicking it, or a lack of cultural etiquette. So in a lot of countries, like in Russia, you're not supposed to step over the barbell. Like, it's considered disrespectful. Your barbell's considered your training partner. and your training partner is there to make you strong and to, you know, to teach you and to help you develop as an athlete and as a person. And so you treat your equipment with respect, not kindness, but respect, right? You take care of the things that are helping you grow stronger. So in America, we have this idea that we're subjugating the barbell. We're at war with the weights. The barbell is our bitch. And, you know, that idea, that mentality, I think that's what the rule might be aimed at, is like, all these Americans kick the barbell, they touch the barbell with their foot, they scoot it. There's a couple athletes that are here in America that actually kick the bar. Kick the bar hard. And there's no other sport that's an acceptable form of behavior. In fact, in a lot of sports, if you kick the equipment, it's unsportsmanlike conduct. It's considered a violation of sportsmanlike play. And there's not a whole lot of sports out there where if you just kick the equipment, it's fine afterward. And like, I couldn't imagine some archer, you know, going up, taking a shot and then punting his bow across the field, you know, if he hit a bullseye. Like, I just don't see it.
But like, what about like if a guy getting ready to pole vault taps his pole with his feet a couple of times to just kind of get a ring out of it? You know, like, so it's
maybe
one thing that occurred to me that I hadn't seen anybody talk about is that it being the International Weightlifting Federation,
right?
There's particularly in the Middle East, a lot of those countries have very different ideas about feet than we do.
Right.
So like, they don't like have their feet touch anything. You don't show somebody the bottom of your foot because right. That's disrespectful in that culture. So one of the only reasons I can think of, because I don't think that there's a very strong argument for it's going to damage the barbell. I don't think there's a very strong argument for like enforcing, like, I think if you made it a rule that you couldn't step over the bar, like, that would be just kind of weird. It's like making it against the rules to walk under a ladder.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's a superstitious thing.
Yeah, it's a superstitious thing.
But I can see that if you are in an international competition with people who have that view of the foot as being disrespectful and inherently bad, then maybe they would think that the bar is unclean if it's touched by the feet of other people. So that's like the one argument that I can kind of see where it's like, okay, well, if we're trying to accommodate the broader cultural implications of what feet mean in different cultures, which is already a crazy idea, right? That like feet mean different things in different places. Like that's kind of weird. But I could see that if it's like bothering a significant group of weightlifters that they feel the bar is unclean because it's been touched by a shoe, then maybe that's a good reason for it. But where I would disagree is like, if the reason for implementing it is purely superstition or tradition, then I don't know how I feel about, you know, like, it's possible to have just too many rules. You know, like, I just think, you know, simplicity is usually the best approach. Like, I was really happy when they got rid of the bar can't touch your hair
rule.
Because that rule just didn't make any sense. Like, who cares if your hair's tall? But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see the first handful of people that have a brain fart on the platform and get no lifted right away trying to set up. But I don't think it's going to change anything overall, because like I said, I don't think it's that big of an issue, and it's not that hard to move the bar with your shin versus your hands. Or if you're one of those people that likes to check if the barbell spins, you can do that with your hands and not your feet.
Yeah.
But also, do you need to check if the barbell spins? It's a competition bar on the platform. Spin. It's probably spinning.
Yeah. Did it spin last time you lifted it? Yeah. Probably did. So, and if it's up there on the platform on a competition stage, then it probably spins. If it doesn't, the loaders will probably notice. And if not, then the lifter who before you probably noticed, and it'll get swapped out. So I think that rule, as far as like the hair goes, that was another rule that kind of was aimed toward a certain ethnic group that potentially, you know, like, let's say with, you know, African Americans, if they wanted to wear an afro, they were discouraged from doing so because the barbell might touch their head. So people with hair that sat up a little bit higher, was that a discriminatory rule towards those types of people?
That's an argument that I've heard. I don't know the exact history, but a coach that I've talked to a bunch of times up in Santa Fe, when I went to his refereeing clinic back in the day, that was a thing that he expressed discontent with that rule because he felt like it was instituted at a time period where he thought that it was a way to try to keep African Americans out of the sport.
It's racist. It's a racist rule.
So I mean, and that's an argument that I had never really heard before. I was like, oh, but that kind of makes sense. And I haven't gone and double checked that opinion or looked at the, you know, exact year that rule was instituted. But I mean, so I think that there are bad rules, or just rules that don't really make sense.
Yeah.
And I don't know, but at the end of the day, just don't kick the bar with your foot.
Yeah.
But I think that it's a big part of people's rituals that they develop, because everybody develops their own superstitious way to approach the bar.
Sure.
And like, for me, that's like setting right hand first, then left hand, doing a couple shoulder shakes. But some people tap the bar and then set up. So I think it's just going to require, like, I think the people that are the most upset about it are just upset that they have to change their setup routine.
Yeah.
Because you get really used to doing it a certain way, and having to change something for what seems like an arbitrary rule can be annoying, but I think it's easy enough to do.
I agree with that. I think, because when you look at a rule, what's a rule designed to do? It's usually designed to make a sport either more fair or designed to keep something from happening that's unfavorable. So in this case, the only thing I can see that there's no really any unfairness with kicking the barbell, other than maybe it's just disrespectful. But as far as like the sport, like improving the sport, I don't really see any reason for it either. It just seems kind of, I'm not gonna say petty or, you know, spiteful, like one of those types of rules, but it really, I don't see why, what it brings to the table, other than possibly, you know, a cultural thing, or maybe just having more respect for the equipment. A lot of the time, a lot of these rules were developed because there wants the body, the governing body of the sport, wants to have a specific cultural mindset. So maybe in our mindset of weightlifting, you shouldn't be kicking the barbell. You shouldn't be tapping it with your foot. You know, and I'm sure that some people are going to be upset about it, and there's those people that have had the setup of kicking the barbell or tapping it or whatever with their foot. Those people are going to be the most vocal about it. But this isn't a barrier to the sport. If you're brand new, you shouldn't be kicking the barbell anyway. Like, if you came to our gym and I saw you doing that, I would tell you to stop immediately. Like, and as a new person, you shouldn't think so highly of yourself as a weightlifter that you can just kick the barbell. Like, the equipment matters, and we try to treat our equipment with decency and be, you know, respectfully of the equipment, because we want it to last. We want it to, you know, be able to use it. If it's your own barbell, I still don't recommend it. Like, it's just like John North when he slams the bars. Like, don't slam the bar because it's not yours. And even if it is yours, you probably shouldn't do it anyway. So as far as rules go, just don't put your feet on the barbell, y'all. And it's pretty simple to avoid. If it's been a setup, part of your setup routine, guess what? You're going to have to change it.
Yeah, and I think, like, I don't know. It seems like a rule that might be, like, well, like you said, like, majority of the time the rules either speed the flow of competition or make things run in an orderly way. But what kind of, like, if it's not the cultural argument that they're making, it's just enforcing somebody's pet peeves on the platform. And I just kind of see, like, I have a different feeling about, like, bar slamming. The reason I'm not worried about the equipment when that happens, it's just, I think that you think you're way cooler than you are.
You're a douchebag.
Like, you're just, Like, you really think that, you know, like, you're really trying to show off, or like, you know, but I think that, I don't know, it's hard, because like, part of the fun of watching professional weightlifting is seeing some of that showboating and
yeah, maybe that sort a little of stuff. Bit. But I mean, for the average people, like, and we're talking about the elite level lifters, and these guys don't act like that. Like, they don't show up, you know, do a 300 kilo, or a kilo, I'm sorry, a 150 kilo clean and jerk, and just slam the bar and act like a wild person. You know, that's not the typical behavior of an elite weightlifter. Like, most of them are relatively humble. They respect the equipment. It's like, they're not CrossFitters showing up with their shirt off, slamming the equipment, and then kicking the barbell like they're, you know, God's gift to weightlifting.
But here's an interesting thing, though. So, here in this country, I've heard a lot of coaches talk about how they don't like people to tap the bar with their feet.
Okay.
Or step over. But also in this country, it's frowned upon to drop an empty barbell.
Yeah.
But in the rest of the world, where they do think it's bad to step over the bar, and they do try to treat the equipment with more respect, they're also dropping empty barbells. So, like, I mean, you've seen the Russian team just do reps and drop it from overhead, you know? So it's one of those things where it's like, well, if it's really about the equipment, dropping an empty bar is far worse than tapping it with your foot, because tapping it with your foot can't damage it. It might show that you don't love that barbell like it's your mother, but, you know, it's not going to hurt it, whereas dropping it will certainly hurt it. So, like, if we're worried about the equipment, shouldn't we say don't drop the bars in the warm-up room or you'll be disqualified?
Well, it's the warm-up room, and you can't drop an empty barbell on the platform, or I'm sure that would be a rule, too.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, if there's an empty bar on the platform, we've got problems.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there isn't an empty barbell ever on the platform, so that's never really an issue.
Yeah, but if it's about respecting the equipment, they should be enforcing that in the back room, if that makes any sense.
Well, it does, but like, the back room, what you do in the back room isn't necessarily out on the stage.
That's true.
Right? It's like, you know, if you're practicing free throws, what you do, you know, practicing in the back or warming up isn't the same as during the game. Like, you could make a free throw shot, flip the ball off, and then, you know, set up again, right? But if you did that during the game, you get called. You get a technical foul, or you know, you get called for some, you know, some kind of misconduct. Like, you can't do that during the game. So when you're on the platform and you're lifting, that's the game. And kicking the equipment during the game isn't allowed anymore. So suck it up.
Yeah.
Change your setup. That's what it's going to be.
Regardless of whether you think it's silly or not, them's the rules that we have to abide by.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, there's always something that, you know, is changing and it's new or that gets shuffled around, and this is just one of those things. And it's not just one person's pet peeve, because IWF changed the whole rule set because of it. So it had to be more than one person just saying, oh, well, I want this rule implemented. It had to be voted on. It had to be ratified by the Technical Congress, and then it's in the rule book now. So it's not like one person said, oh, this is my pet peeve, you guys can't kick the barbell anymore. A lot of countries had input on this. Ursula is the IWF vice president, so she had some say in it. So she probably didn't raise enough of a stink about it if it didn't get shut down at her level.
Yeah, I just don't think it's going to impact things enough to be super upset about. It's just an interesting...
Yeah,
it's just an interesting thing to wonder about is what's setting that up. Because, like, I don't know, like, we have kind of, you know, different, everybody's got a different culture around equipment. Cause right. Like, I know that, you know, lots of people won't squat on a bearing bar, but I'm fine with people squatting on a bearing bar. That doesn't bother me. You're not going to break it squatting.
Yeah.
If you squatting heavy is going to break that Aleco bar, that's a terrible bar. So, like, I think that, you know, the equipment's there to be used. And as long as you're not abusing it or, like, getting mud all over the barbell or something, you know, like, it doesn't personally bother me. But, you know, every gym's got its own kind of different criteria, and I think that has to do a lot with what equipment is in that gym. You know, yeah. If we had one good bar, we'd probably do things differently than when we have 15 of them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like if we all had to share one competition bar, which is how it was at the CrossFit gym before, when I first started out that barbell club, like we had one set of kilo plates and one bearing bar for men, one bearing bar for women. And it was like, oh no, you get to use this bar sometimes. Whereas that's just our default piece of equipment now.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I think it depends on what you've got, but I don't know. It's interesting, but
yeah. The final thing that I thought that might have been a factor is that when they're lifting, they provide rosin to make the bottom of your shoes more sticky.
Oh.
So I thought that maybe tapping the bar with your foot got rosin on the barbell and made it more sticky, or got that rosin substance.
That's actually
on the
a really
barbell
good point.
And made it harder to clean. Made it, you know, maybe uneven in spots in the knurling, made it different. So like,
that's a really great point.
That
bit I haven't thought of that
a possibility too, because they do, especially during clean and jerk sessions, people will put rosin on their shoes to make their feet more tacky. But if you kick the barbell or tap it or whatever, it might get some of that rosin to transfer over and fill in some of the gaps on the knurling, or make it uneven, or make it sticky and cause some problems that way.
Yeah, I think I hadn't thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense. So yeah, those are the new rules, guys. Our part two today is Mundo and I have put a lot of time into this episode, so hopefully we can be a little bit coherent. So all of our notes today are coming from the reading that we did, which is Albert Camus' collection of essays called An Absurd Reasoning, ending with The Myth of Sisyphus. And I think this is one of my favorite kind of pieces, and I've read it a couple times, and you always come away with something new. And so we used the reading ourselves, and then we also listened to some analysis by A Partially Examined Life and Philosophize This. And I think first off, the Myth of Sisyphus, this whole essay and why I love it so much is this is what developed our logo as a gym. So the Sisyphus moving the boulder is the reason I chose that as kind of our logo, is because of I feel like the metaphors for weightlifting can kind of coincide with some of the metaphors that he uses in this. But last week we kind of touched on places that absurdity can arise. So things like, if you really critically look at what you're doing when you watch football, you'll go, what? I'm watching a bunch of other people play a sport and taking enjoyment out of their physical activity and not my own. But where Camus kind of begins, I think it's safe to say, is that when he talks about the absurd, he looks at it as when you are living an examined life, so you're really kind of looking at what you're doing and why you're here and what these things are, you don't really get a lot of direct answers. There's no direct answer that isn't coming from another person whose opinion that is. And when you realize that the questions you're asking don't really have any, aren't getting any answers, and if there is an answer, you can't really know it, and you're aware of the fact that you're eventually going to die, that's the ultimate in absurdity to him, is it's that disconnect between I want to do all of these things and I'm going to be dead and it won't matter. So I think that's kind of his jumping off point. Would you say that's kind of his main point and like his kind of beginning?
I think for what Camus was trying to address was for existence, you know, it's all something that we didn't really ask for. And we brought this up before, is like, we didn't ask to be here. Like, I didn't ask to be here. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't ask to be born in this country, to the family that I was born to, the color of skin I have. Like, I didn't ask for any of it, but yet here I am. And so what Camus is addressing is, you're here, so, and you're conscious. Does your existence matter? Does your life matter? So, and how you go about addressing it is by saying, you know, is life worth living?
Yeah, so this gets to the first section of this essay, which is Absurdity and Suicide. So, to be clear, we are not advocating for killing yourself.
Right.
But he starts his framework by saying, judging whether or not life is worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. All the rest, whether or not the world has three dimensions, the mind has 9 or 12 categories, comes afterwards. So he's saying that when you realize that you're not getting answers to your questions, and in through that you recognize that the fact that you're going to die and you don't have certain answers, he takes it for granted that you're going to say, well, then my life doesn't have a meaning. So he takes that as an operational thing. He says that the absurd is a thing that everybody experiences on some level, and that deep down we all kind of know it. So he takes that for granted, which I think is the first thing that you can question, because I'm not sure everybody really thinks that way. Right. But
yeah.
He's essentially saying that when you recognize that there's no objective meaning to your life and that you're going to die anyway, the first question you have to answer is whether or not it's worth living at all. Which he later goes on to say that it is. But he talks about, you know, various people that killed themselves, and that, you know, there's different types of suicide. There's the despair of losing someone and kind of, you know, just kind of hating your station in life and feeling like you don't have an ability to change things. Like, feeling like you're stuck in a rut.
Yeah, or feeling like life is too unfair.
Yeah, the uncaring universe. So yeah. I think that the times... And what we have to remember is the historical context, because he was writing this after World War II and the Holocaust, and he was French, so he suffered through the worst of that.
Yeah.
And I think the common sentiment was, how could this possibly happen? What kind of universe do we live in that allows this to happen? But he also says that there are just as many suicides for kind of political reasons or ideological reasons. So I think one of the lines here, he says, you know, I think it's something along the line of something worth living for is also something worth dying for. Right. So having these really entrenched ideas can kind of lead you to negate your own life.
And that involves politics as well as religion.
Yep.
And people who commit what is referred to by Camus as philosophical suicide are the people that fall into the camps of religious and, you know, political suicide, because you adopt a belief and that belief becomes your reason for living, and you create a confirmation bias based on those beliefs. So then you only look at things that confirm what you already know about that thing and believe about that thing. So whatever, you know, side of the fence you're on politically, or whatever religion you choose to adhere to, or even choose to not adhere to, even atheism, if you're devoutly atheist, you're forming a political or philosophical version of suicide as well, because you're saying that this is an absolute. And yeah. Absolutes aren't good things to abide by, because then you create a bias in your thinking that only attracts you to information that confirms what you already believe.
Yeah, and I got the feeling that... So Camus' two types of suicide is... So he says there's kind of two parts to the absurd. And one is the fact that you're living, and then the other is that there isn't a meaning. And... He says that literal suicide is solving the first problem. It's solving the fact that you're living.
Right.
But that doesn't rectify the, you know, quest for meaning or any of those sort of things. So he looks at that as kind of a cop-out. But then he looks at philosophical suicide, which is maybe replacing Marxism or Christianity as your meaning, where you're working towards a utopia or something other or another world. And he looks at that as a cop-out because he seems to think that that's resolving the other part, but not resolving, like, so that's substituting meaning on, but it's not something you can truly know. And it seems like he's really a skeptic about most things. Like, he doesn't really think that we can truly know anything. We're kind of limited by our senses and our reason, and that there are some things that he just seems to think that we can't possibly understand. You know, he says that the mind's first step is to distinguish what is true and false, but then you kind of end up in this situation where if you look at it long enough, you can't really know for certain. So he also criticizes science in this, which I found really interesting, in that he's basically saying that just being able to discover more and what the unbreakable pieces are and what the structure of things is can be easily mistaken as like saying this is what it's about, but it's really just saying what the structure of things is. You can't say, you can't extrapolate a meaning claim from Pluto being a planet or not a planet,
right?
You know, so we can discover these things, but even in that scientific discovery, it only adds to the absurd. Because, like, you know, think about, you know, we used to think that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and that made a lot more sense because we were the most important, clearly. But once we know that we're one of trillions of planets and millions of galaxies, you kind of start to go, oh, it's not that special.
Right. And so... so the point of all this and why we find it interesting is because when we think about our day-to-day lives, right, there's a lot of routine in them. And when Grayson picked the logo for the gym, it's Sisyphus. And the myth of Sisyphus is that he has to roll a boulder as a punishment from the gods because he tricked them, and his punishment involves pushing this boulder up to the top of a hill and then watching it roll back down again, only to have it to complete the same task again once he's back down that hill. So without getting too thick and name dropping about all kinds of philosophers and you know, very difficult and muddy philosophical theories, basically this is like, why are you here? And does it matter if you are or not? And it's just a question that I think everybody should ask themselves, because if later in this essay of Camus, he basically says that understanding who you are will help you find your place in the universe, where you need to be. And where, when you know where you need to be, then you'll also have a better idea of who you are. So then the things that you believe in, the things that you do hold dear and value, those things will become meaningful to you. So if let's take this to the everyday person, all right? You're going to work. If you're listening to this podcast today, tomorrow's Monday, all right? You get up, you go to 7 o'clock, you wake up, you get ready for work, you eat your breakfast, if you eat breakfast, then you go to work, you check your email. You do your work, you grab lunch, you work some more, then you get off for the afternoon. If you're involved in some physical activity, you go do that. If you're a weightlifter, you come to the gym and you lift weights. And then you go home, maybe watch some TV, and then you go to bed. And then Tuesday, you do the same thing. And then Wednesday, you do the same thing. And Thursday, you do the same thing. And Friday, you do the same thing. And then you have a little spurt in on the weekend where you get to do some, maybe some cool stuff, or you binge watch something, or you know, do some other type of activity, or you do a variation of whatever you did during the week. And then guess what? Back on Monday, you're starting it all over again. So what I'm saying is, and what we're getting at is that this is the absurdity, is that if you don't look at your life and examine it, what's the point?
Yeah, what's the end?
Yeah, what is the end?
And I think that, you know, that's why, you know, he chose Sisyphus as the metaphor for the modern person, is that, you know, that cycle of go to work, eat dinner, watch TV, go to bed, repeating itself, you know, that's how he views kind of the modern life. And what he says is that you're essentially, like, you have to acknowledge that struggle is, you know, as if you were condemned, because he talks a lot about the absurd and how it kind of ties in to freedom, where if you're, you know, truly free, then you have these, you know, seemingly endless decisions you can make. And if you're not paying attention, you can kind of end up depriving yourself of a lot of experiences you could have, and, you know, trick yourself into thinking it's really, really important that you get that promotion at work, and you sacrifice all of the other things that you could be doing, whether it's training as hard as you want to, or spending time with your family, or, you know, reading books that you like. You know, you end up sacrificing these things towards something that the world has told you is important, but if you really reflect on it, it's not that important what your job is. It's not that important how much money you make, because it's not going to last. It's not a thing that you can carry with you. I think I really like that metaphor, but I don't really know if it's always accurate, you know? Like, at what point... Well, because he says that you have to be careful not to, like, trick yourself into creating meaning in something that isn't there. So, like, we have to be careful that we're not accidentally committing philosophical suicide. Right. So we're not substituting, you know, science or atheism in place of a belief in a God to just make us feel do the exact same thing.
Right.
I really like his idea that you have to kind of, well, so he talks about the absurd hero, which is kind of a, I feel like maybe a self praising sort of kind of like he you know, so he thinks that but he talks about it as being brave, right? So he thinks that it's bravery that allows you to recognize that nothing has any real meaning, but do it anyway out of spite. So he kind of talks about, in the Sisyphus metaphor, which is kind of the last section of this piece, which, if you want to read any of this, just read the last two pages, the actual myth of Sisyphus. The rest of the article is interesting, but kind of confusing and 20 pages long. Myth of Sisyphus really concisely brings it all back together. But, you know, it's that he essentially gives Sisyphus this attitude that in the time it takes him to walk back down to the bottom of the mountain and begin pushing the boulder again, he has this hour of consciousness and a feeling of accomplishment, even though he knows that that he's going to have to do it again. It's that striving and doing it as well as he can and enjoying it that is his spite to the gods. So he's saying, oh, you thought this was punishment, but take this, I'm going to enjoy it. And he thinks that that's kind of the way that we should live. So one of his really interesting things is that he does kind of come around to saying you shouldn't kill yourself, because that's not the right way out.
Right.
But you also shouldn't buy into anything that gives you certainty. So he says that, you know, man should die, unreconciled and not of your own free will. So you should die just living in that, this is just so crazy that we're even here, and there's no possibility that if there is a truth that I can know it. which is so that leads him to say that the purpose is quantity of experience. So he doesn't even say that you should live your life in a way that increases the quality of your experiences, but that you should live a life that increases the quantity of things that you can do. So, like, you know, he gives kind of an example of two people that are, you know, both 40 or whatever when they die, but one has been caught in his work TV bed loop, mm-hmm. and the other has read and met with people and kind of gone places and interacted with family. And what he's saying is that the person who lived more in the time that they had is really what we should be striving for, is that quantity of experience. And he doesn't even say that it needs to be good. It's just living and pushing through it and finding little things you can enjoy on your walk back down the mountain between your struggles. You know, that's kind of where he lands, is, you know, the whole point, you know, the last line before Myth of Sisyphus is the point is to live. And, you know, so he thinks that there's a bravery in living your life as full as possible, knowing full well that you're not really doing anything.
Yeah, and the absurdity, it's paired with what that feeling of what's futile. And anything, if you do anything for a long time and you never get better at it, you would say, like, what's the point? Why should I keep doing this? And that's all it is like, life is this gigantic experience of doing some of the things that we do over and over again, and then just asking ourselves, like, what's the point? Like, why are we doing this? And the point that Camus is bringing up is that the point is to live. Just live your life, live as many experiences as you can, and try not to let those experiences be diluted with what I like to call almond milk philosophies, right? So, like, you'll have political, religious, you know, ideas, or you'll have, you know, your church is watching the football game on Sunday, right? And you do that religiously. But those are all almond milk philosophies. And what I mean by that is, like, they're substitutes for something else. And so, like, and it's not even real milk. You don't get milk from almonds, right? So
yeah.
It's not even a real thing. So you have to be mindful of what you're doing with your time and what you're doing with yourself and with what you're doing with your thoughts, and not buying into any one thing so wholeheartedly that that's the only thing you ever see. And so, like, the whole idea behind introducing you to this topic is that you think about who you are, like, where you want to be and why you want to be there. Mitch Hedberg was a comedian, and
that's
he
great.
Would be famous for one-liners. And one time he was driving to a radio station, and, you know, he showed up and he introduced himself to the DJ. And so the DJ sat down with him and he says, "So who are you?" And Mitch Hedberg had this thought. He's just like, is he being really deep, or am I at the wrong radio station? So life can be like that. It can be that absurd. It's just, you know, where you are, where you're at, and where you want to be all take some thought. You know, a lot of the time we have those philosophies of begin with the end in mind. You know, do things, plan things out in the long run, right? But know that they might not even work out. Even if you did your best, even if you did, you know, everything right, it still might not work out for you. And that's the absurdity of life. That's the absurdity of our existence, is that you could be given everything. You could be born into the perfect family. You could be born into the perfect, you know, proportions to be an elite weightlifter. You could have, you know, the best facilities, or, you know, be born in the best neighborhoods, be given the best education, and still end up a failure in life. And that's the absurdity of it. That's the unfairness of it. And there's nobody that's going to give you any answers. There isn't a call center at the end of the universe where somebody's going to pick up and say, "Oh yeah, that's the right answer. You got it." Unfortunately, we all have to devise and extract those meanings for ourselves. So Camus is saying, live your life, because life is interesting to live, and just do as much of it as you possibly can.
Yeah, and I think that that idea about unfairness kind of allows us to kind of paint a really what I think is like the clearest example of philosophical suicide, which is, you know, your bad things are going to happen to you, and especially, you know, there tends to be more unpleasant things than pleasant things. And, you know, whether tragedy befalls you or you don't succeed in the thing that you wanted to try, you know, the clearest example of philosophical suicide to me, which, again, the point of philosophical suicide is a way to resolve the absurd, is you say, I don't know why these things are happening to me. The universe is really unfair and uncaring, but God works in mysterious ways. And that's, I think, the clearest example of that idea of philosophical suicide. Is saying, this doesn't make any sense, but there's a higher order reason that exists that I just need to trust. And, you know, kind of... And maybe it does take a certain degree of bravery to say, the universe is horribly unfair, and that's it. Like, that's the last line, you know?
Yeah, that is part of the essay, and he does say that.
So yeah, you know, I think another illustration he used is that the presence of God, there's less a problem of freedom than a problem of evil. You know the alternative. Either we are not free and God is all-powerful and responsible for evil, or we are free and responsible, but God is not all-powerful. So it's kind of that conundrum where it's like, well, how, if there is this kind of universal order, then why are school shootings still happening? Why are, you know, a million people dying of dysentery in Yemen right now, if the world and the universe has this true, just kind of underpinning? And, you know, I think that that's, for me personally, like, that's, you know, one of the main reasons that I think the way that I do, is because you just recognize that, you know, like, you can do everything right and bad things are going to happen to good people. Yeah. And it's because the universe as a whole doesn't really care. You know, we're here, but we're not here for it.
Right.
We're, and that's it. That's where you end up with that question, is you're just here. And what are you going to do about it? And, I think that idea of living with the absurd and pursuing the things that you find interesting or valuable, and not necessarily in a strict, like, hedonistic physical pleasure sense, but there's enjoyment in the struggle of things. And I think that's where the metaphor of the boulder comes in, because when you pick a goal and you strive towards it, whether or not you are successful in the end, there's an enjoyment in the process of mastery. There's an enjoyment in the process of bettering yourself and taking on challenges. And he just feels that doing that whilst having the contradictory simultaneous thought that it also doesn't matter is the way to be authentically living.
Yeah. So in essence, the world isn't fair. You can't kick the barbell anymore. And if you do, you're going to get penalized for it. But in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter, because you're going to lift the weight anyway. And that should make you happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So let's wrap things up on that note. Grayson, do you want to add anything else at the last minute?
I think I'll just end with the end of the quote. Like, this is my favorite quote from this piece. And it's the last line in Myth of Sisyphus. I leave Sisyphus at the foot of the mountain. One always finds one's burden again. But Sisyphus teaches us the higher fealty that negates the gods and raises rocks. He too concludes that all is well. This universe, henceforth without a master, seems to him neither sterile nor futile. Each atom of that stone, each mineral flake of that night-filled mountain, in itself forms a world. The struggle itself towards the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. All right, guys.
All right,
don't get too bummed out now.
Yeah, just something to think about. All right, y'all. Happy lifting.